This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. On today's shows, we are tackling road traffic issues. And joining us is special guest Howard Dembowski, who's the founder of the Justice Project South Africa. Welcome to you, Howard.
Thanks very much, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here, and let's hope we can clear up some issues for the listeners.
Yeah, Howard's the man who claims to know more about road traffic matters than the Minister of Transport. Welcome again.
Claims to. Yes, I also don't claim to be a politician, not a priest. I'm neither.
So what we've done today, Howard, we've extracted a whole lot of questions that have been posted by members of Legal Talk South Africa, with whom we've teamed up. The founder there is Ray Green, and with their Facebook membership of about 124,000 plus, we're going to pull those questions. We're going to deal with them, you and I. So let me give you an idea of what it's all about. I received one of the questions posted. I received a fine from a traffic officer, even though I gave him my license card and spelt my address to him by letter by letter. He still wrote down the wrong surname and ID number. Is the fine still valid? We'll talk about all that. Hold it for a moment. One of the other questions, the Port Elizabeth Traffic Department have instituted a ghost squad. It's undercover with unmarked forks, VW Golfs, driving around randomly, pulling people off the road. They want to know if it's legal, and I can see you twitching and you're getting a bit red in the face. Is it dangerous for women? One of them asks. We'll deal with that, Howard. Another one is, I live in a boomed-off area in a very quiet cul-de-sac. Is it illegal to kick a ball in the road with my son? And my neighbor has an issue with this one, that the poster says, and they came and took pictures of her children, which I'm not too keen on. So we're going to deal with those in detail. Let's just give out our details of Cliff Central. We are Law, L-A-W, at cliffcentral.com. Our Facebook page, The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg, and our Twitter handle at Hertzlaw, H-E-R-T-Z-L-A-W. Are you looking forward to this one, Howard?
Always.
Okay. He's the man feared by every traffic department in the country. Howard Dembowski's taken, I don't know, you've been in more court cases than I have.
That's probably true, Gary.
Okay, let's take one of them. The first one, Howard, it comes from Marion. She writes, as I said earlier, the Port Elizabeth Traffic Department have got this ghost squad, and they're moving around in unmarked cars, pulling people off the road. Is it legal, and how dangerous is it for women? She says, what about for men or for children or for anyone?
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Firstly, let's just be clear that this idea of unmarked traffic policing cars is not unique to Port Elizabeth. It is something that's practiced throughout the whole of South Africa, but by special permission from the Director of Public Prosecutions for the particular province concerned. And the reason for that is that, you know, generally one should know that it is a traffic law enforcement vehicle that's on your backside, if there is one. Mm. And I would suggest that the directors of public prosecutions in the various provinces have lost touch with reality. And the reason I say that is it wasn't that long ago, it was a couple of weeks ago, at the very most a month ago, that a young lady was stopped by two alleged JMPD officers in an unmarked motor vehicle in Fairland, and was raped by those individuals. Mm. And there have been repeated cases of bogus police. Buying blue lights for your vehicle is as easy as walking into a flea market. Mm. If you want the better quality stuff, then you have to go to more specialized places. But you can get those blue lights. Absolutely no problem, no identification required, etc. And it's highly insensitive of the directors of public prosecutions to bury their heads in the sand and say that this bogus police issue isn't real. It is very, very real. So much so that in 2013, the RTMC and Justice Project South Africa got together and put together something called a Blue Light Protocol, which was aimed at advising people what to do if an unmarked vehicle was trying to pull you over with blue flashing lights. And it went into a number of different procedures that you should follow, including not stopping, slowing down to a speed of 40 kilometers an hour, gesturing to them to follow you, etc. But unfortunately, our friends at the RTMC, being the kinds of friends that they are, did not actually communicate that to SAPS or to the traffic departments. And as a result, you see people actually taking that advice, slowing down, gesturing to them to follow them. And the next thing, the cops open fire on them. Or when they get to the police station, they jump out and beat the living daylights out of these people. Now, that is just not a conducive situation to law enforcement. And I might say is actually enabling hijacking and bogus police. So it's time that our people who sit in ivory towers actually grew up and realize that this is a very real problem. If you don't take decisive action in order to prevent this kind of thing from happening, it's going to happen. But here's another thing. The unmarked provincial traffic police cars with speed measuring equipment in them, they're not Foxies, by the way. That's the first time I've heard of them referred to as Foxies. They're VW Golf GTIs.
Yes.
Okay, those things
but they're Foxies, aren't they?
Yeah, they're actually like the proverbial of a shovel. Those things are quite quick.
Yes.
But in any event, what these guys do is they tend to actually goad people into speeding by pulling up to their rear end, pulling back, pulling up to their rear end, pulling back. Mm-hmm. People see this in their rear view mirrors and say to themselves, oh God, I've got hijackers on my backside. It doesn't matter that these people are wearing uniforms inside a vehicle. I don't need to tell you that your windscreen is reflective. You can't see inside that vehicle. So, as I said, come directors of public prosecutions, shall I name a few? Tom Dekker, who's the DPP for Johannesburg. George Baloyi, who's the DPP for Pretoria. Christina van der Pfeiffer, who's the DPP for Cape Town. Come, let's get sensible now. Let's withdraw these authorizations and let's have proper, visible traffic law enforcement. You know what? Nothing beats it.
Yeah, absolutely. Wilma Potgieter wrote, she said, if it does happen to you, give hand signals for them to follow you to the nearest police station.
Exactly.
Is that a possibility? Is that what they should do in PE right now?
That was part of our blue light protocol. Yeah, and, you know, the fact is, yes, you can do that, but you do risk getting beaten up or shot at by these people. And, you know, with due respect, look, I certainly would not stop for any vehicle that's unmarked, that's got blue flashing lights, and I'd be very cautious about stopping for one that is marked, actually, given the fact that whole bogus police cars are up for hire and it's been exposed in the media.
So what's the answer, Howard?
The answer is, firstly, don't drive like a doer. That's the first thing. Mm. Obey the speed limits. Obey road traffic signs. And that way you'll be sure that you haven't committed a road traffic offense.
Mm.
Okay. If suddenly now someone's starting to try and pull you over and you do feel uncomfortable, obviously, getting raped is not an option for a lady. Plain and simple.
Mm.
You know what? Drive to the closest police station, but do so slowly. Don't, for goodness sake,
speed away.
Put your foot flat
and
think that legitimate cops won't think that you are now a criminal trying to evade them.
Let's take another one. Comes from Renee. She says, I received a fine by a traffic officer with a camera on a national road. The officer wrote the surname and ID number incorrectly, although I gave him my license card. I spelt my address to him letter by letter, and it's also incorrect. Is the fine still valid?
Well, let's clear up one thing first. Cameras don't measure speed. Speed measuring equipment measures speed.
Yeah.
And sometimes a camera is attached to that. Now, if there was a camera attached to this particular speed measuring equipment, then there would presumably be a video or a photograph of that particular vehicle, which would accompany that particular Section 56 written notice to appear in court.
Yeah.
However, if all of the particulars on that notice are incorrect, then don't just leave it and say, it's incorrect, they'll never be able to trace me. Like I've seen some of the advice says, oh, they're not going to be able to trace you, ignore it.
Yeah.
One of these days, you're driving along on holiday, and at the most inopportune time, there's a roadblock and a warrant for your arrest has been issued because the court has condoned those inaccuracies.
Because they have your registration number, is that what you say?
That's what I'm saying.
And they pick that up. Pick that off the eNATIS system.
That is correct.
So whether it's incorrect on the traffic ticket doesn't mean a damn. They can get the right information off the off their system.
You're an attorney. I don't need to tell you that a legal document must be 100% accurate and is not allowed to contain any alterations. But unfortunately, when we talk about road traffic law when we talk about law,
completely different.
There are completely different issues, and we should never actually tag the word law onto road traffic.
So the advice we're giving Renee now is don't neglect this, even though the information's incorrect.
Take that particular summons to the public prosecutor, or preferably the senior public prosecutor at the magistrate's court that's cited on that summons. Go to that public prosecutor and say to them, this is a defective notice. What are you going to do about it? And I can tell you now, 99.999% of the time, that prosecutor is going to withdraw the matter.
Most people who responded to Renee said, ignore the darn thing. They'll never find you.
Look.
This is the
Gary.
This is the public's perception of this.
This is the problem, and it's something that I find myself constantly battling with, and that is that we have an enormous volume of armchair experts.
Yeah.
Who, I can give you advice if I don't know you from a bar of soap, and what impact is it going to have on my life if things go wrong? The fact is, you know what? Traffic fines, just like any other legal matter, if you ignore them, chances are they could go south or pear-shaped. If you don't ignore them and if you deal with them, then chances are that you could actually deal with it in a satisfactory manner to yourself.
Yes.
First and foremost.
Here comes another one similar, Howard. Comes from Rene as well, but not the same Rene. I have both surnames. This Rene says, I missed a court date for a summons that's in Piet Retief, Mpumalanga, for a traffic fine and have no way of getting there, so she says. And then she explains, I was stopped and given the fine, but I didn't sign for it. I don't think that matters a damn. I'm meant to be in court today, so I assume a warrant has not yet been issued. She's like, what should I do kind of thing. I mean, for goodness sake.
Well, it's very simple. Yeah. You can't turn around and say, I had no way of getting there after the fact. You could turn around to the public prosecutor prior to the court date and say, I don't have a means to get here, in which case the court will pay your travel expenses.
By train, they give you a certain...
Exactly. So, you know, don't come with this, oh, I can't get there nonsense.
Sorry, let me just clear that up. If you don't have the wherewithal to get to court, can you apply and the court will pay your transport?
It'll pay your transport.
But it's not going to pay fancy transport.
No.
It's going to pay an airfare to Cape Town. It's going to...
If you have to go from Joburg to Pretoria, they will pay for you to go on Metro Rail, not on the Gautrain.
No.
So please don't be under any illusion that you're going to get a trip, free trip on the Gautrain.
Well, how do they do it? Do they send you the money? They put it into your bank account?
No.
How does it work?
Well, the fact is that the court actually reimburses you, so they expect you to borrow it. Yeah. But, you know, there is another way of achieving that purpose, and I'm going to sound awfully sarcastic here. Yeah. They could always send a police vehicle to chuck you in the back of and drive you to court.
Which is what they will do at some point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Once a warrant for your arrest has been issued, that's a serious matter, Gary.
Yeah.
The fact is that the majority of warrants of arrest for road traffic matters that I've seen executed are executed after 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. So guess what?
They lock you up for the weekend.
That's it. Yeah. And the sad part of that is because it's on a warrant, there is no question of you being released prior to appearing before that magistrate. And let's just clear something up about warrants of arrest under or in terms of road traffic prosecutions. When a warrant for your arrest has been issued, it's been issued for contempt of court. Mm. It has not been issued because you have been found guilty in absentia.
Or that you exceeded the speed limit or whatever. It's only because you didn't come to court. Yeah.
Our Constitution does not allow for a trial to be concluded in the absence of the person who is actually the accused.
Yeah.
But contempt of court is a serious matter, and I might tell you, and people need to bear this in mind, it's a criminal matter.
Yes.
You can get a criminal record for it. So if you can't attend court on a particular court date, then make sure that you make arrangements up front.
With the prosecutor.
With the prosecutor, so that prosecutor may say to the magistrate, this person was unable to attend, it was prearranged. The magistrate doesn't have a hissy fit. Yeah. But you can imagine being
there. He issues a warrant, doesn't he? Which is stayed or suspended? Or what is it? Do they just postpone
it? No, if the matter has been prearranged and postponed, very simple. There is no such thing of it even being on the court roll. So it probably wouldn't even go before the magistrate.
Yeah. I've heard people saying, I've made an arrangement with the prosecutor and he didn't stick to it, and the next thing it was a warrant. Be very careful with that.
In writing, everything.
Absolutely, in writing.
Absolutely.
Make sure it's confirmed by email or something that he agreed to postpone it or whatever in your absence.
Look, it's not going to help you much when you're driving along and you're suddenly arrested at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon.
Anyone that has a warrant for their arrest because they didn't attend and they're kind of hoping it'll go away, what should they do about it?
Stop hoping it's going to go away. It's not. Yeah.
You're going to get picked up at a roadblock.
The fact is that our traffic authorities have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of warrants of arrest because they don't comply with the conditions of those warrants of arrest. Yeah. That warrant of arrest says, go to Gary's house and arrest him.
Yes.
What they do is they say, ooh, that's too much effort.
We'll wait for
him. Yeah. We'll set up a roadblock on the R21 on a weekday for 2.5 hours while people are trying to drive to the airport, and we'll delay all of them and we'll arrest a princely sum of 16 people whilst we've inconvenienced 10,000 motorists. That doesn't matter. Yes. But these traffic authorities in this country are lazy. They do not execute those warrants of arrest. But, you know, Murphy is one of those horrible sods that will come up and slap you behind the ears.
Yeah.
At the most inopportune time.
So the advice is get to that court immediately and
get to that court
sort it out
as quickly as possible. Yep. Go and sort it out.
Yep.
You can walk in. You can ask the public prosecutor to put it on the roll immediately.
Mm.
And
you'll pay your fine for not appearing in court plus
if you had a valid excuse, you may not necessarily be held to that
fine.
Maybe
not. So, if you have a doctor's certificate.
You know, exactly. Yeah. I was lying in hospital and both my legs were chopped off is pretty much a valid excuse. It's not a fait accompli that just because a fine has been issued against you, you're necessarily guilty. That's not how our criminal justice system works in South Africa.
This one gets you going a bit, Howard. I live in a boomed-off area in a very quiet cul-de-sac. Is it illegal? This comes from Jonathan in Randburg. Is it illegal to kick a ball in the road with my son? He says that my neighbors are a problem here. They say they're going to get me stopped and they're going to use the bylaws against me. And they came out today and took photos of my kids. They said this was for evidence. Is there anything they can do? Also, are they allowed to take photos of my kids? What do you think? We can leave the kids for a moment. We'll come to playing. What about in the township? Don't kids play in the township? Football, isn't that a way of life in a quieter street?
I'm actually quite grateful that I didn't answer that in writing, because if I'd done so on the spur of the moment, I would have said it's a great pity that being stupid is not a crime, because you should be locked up. Okay, and the reason that you should be locked up is that you, as a responsible adult, should know that there are things called playgrounds and there are things called roads. Roads are for motor vehicles. playgrounds are for children to kick balls around in. Okay? And quite frankly, sir, stand still and I'll come kick you in the balls. Because you are stupid to even think that your child is going to live, grow up, and spend the rest of their natural life in your boomed off area. At some stage, they are going to go and visit a friend who doesn't live in that boomed off area, and they're going to go and play football in the middle of on Decker's Road with an 80 kilometer an hour speed limit, and it's a dual carriageway with two lanes in each direction, and they're going to get flattened. And then guess who you're going to blame? Because you're a prick. You are going to blame the person who was driving the vehicle. You're not going to blame yourself for teaching your kid that the place to play is in the road. It is not in the road. Let's not talk about townships and kids playing soccer in the streets in townships. You know what? That can be prevented with proper adult supervision as well. And it is in a lot of instances. You know, let's not cast stereotypes here. It's just like these residential communities and their gated communities who think that they can impose their own speed limits and start enforcing road traffic laws. There's one in Pretoria, a very big one, that imposes a fine of 250 Rand for driving drunk on their roads.
In the estate.
In their estate. Oh. Those roads are...
That's not a public road.
They are public roads.
Within the estate.
Every single road to which the public has access is a public road. So guess what, all you people with your hoity-toity, fancy, schmancy attitudes of, we've got private roads, we can put up our own speed signs, we can do this, we can do that, and we can get a traffic officer, a security guard to come and stop people and demand to see their driving licenses and take them to task in terms of the National Road Traffic Act. Yeah, you want to know something? In order to qualify as a traffic officer now, you have to spend 3 years in college. Not 3 days in a security officer's training course. Or, in some cases, 3 hours. The fact is that these people need to grow up. If you want to create safe environments within your housing communities, then do so. There are a plethora of different traffic calming measures that you can actually install. People always talk about speed humps and all that kind of stuff. They fail to talk about things like single direction crossings in a single road. So, in other words, when you approach it, you've either got to give way to me or crash into me head on, and vice versa. They don't talk about raised intersections, which in Milnerton have reduced crashes, actually, not even fatalities, crashes on one particular public road there over a period of 18 months from several tens of multiples to zero. The fact is that you cannot, in terms of the law, enforce those laws, but similarly, you can't make rules that are inconsistent with the rest of legislation. And if you want to do that, then may I suggest that you call your complex Oranya.
Howard, let's talk about taking pictures of the children playing soccer. I mean, if it's for evidentiary material matter, then it's in order.
Absolutely.
The Criminal Procedure Act is very clear on this one, that any person who takes images for any purpose not related to the detection of crime or the investigation of an offence is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a period not exceeding 15 years. So if you're taking it...
Of a crime scene.
Yeah.
Okay, a crime scene.
But detection of a crime. If you're taking pictures of kids playing in the street, there's a crime happening there.
Doubt about it.
He's entitled to take pictures. We're raising this, Howard, there were literally dozens and dozens of replies to this boomed-off area.
Yep.
Incident of people taking pictures of your kids playing soccer.
Yep.
And people were going crazy about how dare they take pictures of my kids, you know, that kind of thing. But if they're breaking the law, I guess you can use that, take the pictures and use it for evidence.
I think we also have to look at decided cases regarding privacy, where it's been repeatedly decided in the High Court that when you are out in public, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy. So therefore, anyone may take your photograph of you doing anything.
Well, I wouldn't like people taking pictures of my kids sitting anywhere just for the sake of it. We would all be rebellious there, and we would have the right. Howard, let's not go there. Let's move on to because you were talking about estates. So here's one for you. It comes from Penny. This is going to get your blood boiling, everything does really to do with traffic. She says, Penny, please advise the legality of security guards in estates asking for driver's licenses, and also it applies to business premises when they scan your license. How do you feel about that?
I have a huge problem with it, as do a lot of my colleagues in law enforcement. And in the know,
isn't there? Sorry, if I can give you the back end of this. If you don't give it to them, they don't let you in.
Yeah, which they actually have no right to do, by the way. But of course, your homeowners associations make up these rules that you allegedly agree to on the basis of a sign at the gate that says "I agree to the rules."
But business parks as well. Business parks don't let you in unless you get many of them.
I agree. Yeah. And it's going to turn around and bite these security companies, housing estates, business parks, etc., right where it hurts very, very shortly.
Why is that?
The Protection of Personal Information Act not an insignificant piece of legislation. Mm. And yes, they may ask me who I am and who I'm coming to visit. But the second that they need to know that expires, then they must destroy my information. What these companies are doing, and this will probably put the screaming heebie-jeebies of people.
And me. Yeah. Are they keeping my information?
They are not only keeping it, but they're uploading it to the cloud, which is probably one of the least secure environments that you could wish to come across. And I've dealt with numerous matters, the worst of which was where a lady who was a proxy for a car hire company went to go license a vehicle and got told by the licensing department, but you don't own the vehicle anymore. The company doesn't own the vehicle anymore. And after passing this matter on to the RTMC's anti-corruption unit, we discovered that not only was the vehicle transferred out of that company's name, but in addition to that, seven other motor vehicles were registered and licensed on the identical particulars. Yeah. Okay, so they were literally clones of that vehicle. It's very, very dangerous, and I wish that these housing estates would become more sensitive to this kind of issue. You know what? If somebody's going to commit a crime within your residential community, they're going to do it with false documentation anyway.
Okay. Absolutely.
So the fact is,
it's stupid.
And in fact, a lot of the incidents that have occurred, especially the particularly gory ones, have not resulted out of people coming to visit those estates. They've resulted out of people who are actually resident in those estates.
Or building within the estate,
They're resident in those estates. There was one in Pretoria where BMW X5 was used in the commission of a house robbery and murders. And there was no record of that vehicle coming or going from the estate.
Let's move, Howard. We've got so many questions. Pelessa says, I'm stuck in traffic on the N14 and one guy just drove into my car because my car is black. He couldn't see it. My next car will be neon green, she says. Is there any truth, Howard, in black cars being more likely to be involved in crashes?
Silver cars, black cars, any of these cars that camouflage themselves into the roadway. Traffic officers' uniform, the camel-colored traffic officers' uniform that the provincial cops wear. Yeah. It's all camouflage on the roads. I love the idea of a neon green car. Great idea. But that's not going to help you if the plonker behind you happens to be looking somewhere other than the road. Because this is what happens, particularly in traffic, where someone gets distracted, they're busy messing around on their cell phone, they're checking their Facebook status, and they want to see how many likes they've got, and all that kind of nonsense. And the next thing they do, they're up your behind. Now, that kind of thing, you know, high-speed collisions, yes, definitely the color of your vehicle does make a big difference to visibility. But in heavy traffic, I don't think so.
What about CJ Richter? He says, I would like to find out if it's legal to text or change a song on your cell phone when at a red light or a stationary in stationary traffic.
The National Road Traffic Act actually prohibits the operation of any handheld cellular device or communications device whilst driving. What it doesn't do is define what the word driving means.
Yeah.
So to some people, when I'm standing still at the traffic lights, that's not driving. And you know what? If they're driving one of these Blue Motion type motor vehicles that switch off at the traffic lights, they probably aren't driving, actually, yeah, if you think about it.
What about a kit, one of these cell phone kits? You're not holding it, really.
Well, you know, if you have a look at the Bluetooth kits that are relatively cheap to install in vehicles, if you've got to talk on a cell phone while you're driving, okay, that's the way to go. But there's, to my knowledge, nothing that allows you to text whilst you're driving using voice commands. I suppose there are fancy devices that allow you to do that. But just remember this. When you are driving, particularly at speed, you are covering distance over time. Generally, it takes around about 3 seconds to lift up your cell phone, have a look at, read and comprehend the text message. Okay, if you're driving on a freeway at 120 kilometers an hour, you're covering 22.3 meters a second, which means that by the time you look up again, you've traveled nearly 70 meters. Yeah, straight into somebody else, or into a pedestrian that shouldn't be crossing the freeway in the first place. But hey, you know, we don't enforce those kind of laws.
Let's talk about Kevin's posting. He says he's from Cape Town. He says, I received a speeding fine the other day, 80 in a 60 zone. My problem is I got stung for 600, whereas my wife received a fine 6 months ago in the same place, doing the same speed, and her fine was only 150. Is there anything I can do to get it reduced? Aren't traffic fines supposed to be kind of even? So he says.
Well, the latter part of that is that the ARTA Act was supposed to achieve that. There was supposed to be a standard prescribed fine for standard prescribed offences. And that's what Schedule 3 is all about. But as we all know, the ARTA Act was enacted in 1998. It's been in operation in Johannesburg and Swanee for 9 whole years.
Is it working, Howard?
It's working about as well as a chair with 3 legs. it's a complete mess. And the reason for it being a complete mess is it wasn't properly thought out in the beginning.
How do
and
the authorities
people
feel
have messed
about
it up?
In the Joburg and Victoria authorities?
Well, it's common knowledge that the Joburg and Swanee metros have spoken to the Portfolio Committee on Transport and said we want out of this ARTO nonsense. But, you know, part of why they want out of this ARTO nonsense is because they want back into the Criminal Procedure Act nonsense that they also abuse. The fact is that we wouldn't have this nonsense if the law enforcement authorities actually stuck to what they're supposed to be doing and abided by the laws that apply to them. But unfortunately, we don't have that situation. We have a bunch of juveniles here who like pointing fingers at everybody but themselves. And trust me, when I say juveniles, I'm talking about motorists as well. This oak's bitching, excuse the French. He's bitching because he's got himself a fine for more than
his wife got.
His wife got. Okay. Well, maybe his recollection of time isn't as good as he thinks it is, because the city of Cape Town, the chief magistrate there, tripled the fines in Cape Town not that long ago. So that could possibly have contributed to it. But the thing is that, unfortunately, we have more than 700 lower courts in this country, and each of those chief magistrates in those jurisdictions set the traffic fines, which are applicable to those jurisdictions. So, for example, in Joburg, in Ekurhuleni, the fine for skipping a stop street is 500 rand. In Cape Town, it's 2,000 rand. And that kind of disparity is not a good thing. And let me tell you why it's not a good thing. Because it introduces more and more uncertainty. If you know that you're going to get nailed, like, for example, my brother has just returned from Qatar, okay, and is going back there. But the fact is that there, just touching your cell phone is subject to a fine which is equivalent to 2,000 rand. Just touching it whilst you're in your motor car, engine running or not. So, and people behave themselves there. Here, it's a free-for-all because why? Our traffic law enforcement authorities don't enforce the law properly, and people have come to understand this and have said, well, look, I've watched these taxi drivers get away with murder. They get away with it. Why shouldn't I? And there, therein lies your problem.
Okay, Howard, we've got 3 minutes left.
Yes.
We haven't even touched the surface, but you'll be back. It's been so interesting, as always, with you. Justice Project South Africa is your baby. What are you up to? What can we, the public, get from you? You've got 3 minutes to punt yourself because you do a hell of a lot of good work. You're always advising people on road traffic matters. I can tell all our listeners, if there's anything you ever want on road traffic, he's the man to talk to. What's your latest project?
Well, our latest project still remains the registered mail matter that we have in the Pretoria High Court against the Road Traffic Infringement Agency, the JMPD, and the
Tshwane Metro. Ongoing?
That's still ongoing.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very interesting when it's set down.
Very However, quick, in 30
go
seconds.
Go to our website and join as a member, because without member contributions, we cease to exist.
Okay, give your website details.
www.jp-sa.org. And the hyphen, folks, is the minus sign.
Very good, Howard. Lovely to be with you once again. And thank you for all the good information. We really appreciate it. To you, our listeners, many thanks for being with us. And we'll see you next time. Cheers for now.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law. Like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
Presenting the Attorney's Fidelity Fund and the Attorney's Insurance Indemnity Fund on CliffCentral.com. Your champions in the legal profession.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Today is the first in a series of shows in which we introduce the Attorney's Fidelity Fund and the Attorney's Insurance Indemnity Fund. And very simply, the goal of these shows is to increase the awareness of the services provided by these organizations and how they serve and protect you. So the two funds you will hear are committed to ensuring the acceleration of growth in the legal fraternity. And it's for me, as a lawyer, a great honor to host the two gents today. May I introduce you to them? First up, the Chief Executive Officer of the Attorney's Fidelity Fund. It's Mr. Motlatsi Molefe. And a very warm welcome to you, sir.
Thank you, Gary.
Also, Managing Director, Attorneys Indemnity Insurance Fund, Mr. Sipho Mbele. Welcome to you, Sipho.
Thank you, Gary.
May I just mention quickly, Mr. Molefe is an attorney. He has a Management Development Program certificate from Wits Business School and a Master of Business Administration degree, MBA, from Regenesis. Fantastic, gents. Also, Sipho, you hold an MBA and a BSc.
Yes.
Yeah, it's quite strange to have both, business and science, but there you go.
Thank you.
Great to have you gents heading up organizations that are so important to the public and to us lawyers. Let's first of all shoot with you, Mr. Molefe. Let's discuss both funds. Either you're going to discuss both or you'll share it between you. So we have the two attorneys' fidelity fund on the one hand and attorneys' indemnity insurance fund on the other. Please tell us what these funds are.
Okay. To start with, the attorneys' fidelity fund is a creature of statute set up in terms of the Attorneys Act as far back as some 73-74 years ago, but repeated again in terms of extending its life in the 1979 Act, Chapter 2 thereof, from Section 25 going downwards. But the primary objective of the Attorneys Fidelity Fund is basically to reimburse members of the public who have been left out of pocket as a result of theft or misappropriation, whichever way you want to put it, that is committed by practitioners in the course of their practice. Our scope is limited specifically to theft. It could be money. It could be any other property that has been entrusted to an attorney. And in terms of the very same act, you also will note that the act empowers the fund to actually set up a vehicle that will provide professional indemnity cover to all practitioners in the country, which was done when the insurance indemnity fund, which SIPO heads, was actually established, I think, in 1993, if I recall very well.
Okay, so we have the two. The first one, Fidelity Fund, is the one if an attorney steals your money, he runs off with your money, then the Fidelity Fund is there to cover you and protect you, and you'll get that money back if it's there legitimately in the hands of a lawyer's trust account, having emanated from a legal matter.
That is correct.
Right. Now we move to you, SIPO, and we talk about the Attorney's Indemnity Insurance Fund, which means that if a lawyer botches a claim, he forgets to, whatever, the matter prescribes for that matter, the man in the street is covered. Just explain that in a little more detail for us.
Okay. So the first thing is that the man in the street is covered, but only through a process of suing the other attorney through another attorney. So, in the unlike the Fidelity Fund, in our case, you will only have protection if you approach another lawyer in order to sue him for malpractice that might have happened.
Yes.
And the second thing is that we actually limit the benefits that a lawyer could have as indemnity for any malpractice that might have happened. And we, depending on the number of partners or directors in the practice of firm, we will then offer them according to the scale of benefits that we have. So effectively, you will have a member of the public approaching one lawyer and then suing the other, and then we then pay that claim based on the processes that have been undertaken.
Okay, the next question that arises from that really is, does the public have to pay anything for this? And how do these two funds, how do they sustain themselves financially?
Okay, I'm going to answer the question of the public, and then I'll leave Mtlatsi to talk to the funding of the two organizations. At the moment, the public does not have to pay because of the structure that we have of funding the AIIF. What happens is that a practicing attorney is automatically covered by virtue of owning or having a Fidelity Fund certificate that is valid, or at least is supposed to have a Fidelity Fund certificate. But the public does not pay for this PI as such.
Okay.
I think to answer your question, Gary, it's how the Act has structured the whole element of the income of the Attorneys Fidelity Fund that is important, and that covers both ourselves and the AIIF.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, members of the public do not pay directly for any of the services that we offer. We are entitled, in terms of the Attorneys Act, to interest that accrues in a trust account of an attorney. It's diverted to the fund primarily to ensure that the fund remains sustainable throughout. So it's a pooling of resources that emanate from trust accounts of attorneys. But I must make also a particular point. Not all interest emanating from trust accounts held by attorneys come through to the fund. When there is an underlying transaction, for instance, a transfer of property, and you know it's going to take place over a period, say, of 3 to 4 months, an attorney is obliged to invest that money in a Section 78(2) capital A account. So it's a short-term investment.
Mm.
And that short-term investment, the returns thereof go directly to the client. But any other that hasn't been invested in that format, the fruits thereof come to the fund. Having said that, from our resources, with each passing year, beginning from the 1st of July to the end of June the following year, we pay over to the AIIF a premium, which is intended to ensure that whenever there are claims, they are able to meet the claims and actually make sure that no member of the public is left out of pocket. So what we have seen with the sustainability of the fund in the last few years is that with interest rates having dropped to such levels as we see today, our traditional income, which is the receipt of interest from trust accounts, has actually been outstripped our investment income.
Mm-hmm.
So our sustainability today is addressed more by our investment income, which is driven by a particularly well-structured investment strategy on the one hand, and interest rates. And I'll give you a very simple, our income is a function of interest rates.
Mm.
A very simple example. With the last drop in interest rates, I think it was 25 basis points or so, we talk about a reduction of almost 50 million rands in our income at any particular point in time.
Mm. Sipho, you wanted to add something?
I think the most important thing, however, that we must keep in mind is that given the funding that the AFF receives, and that funding comes out of the fees that clients pay to the practitioners, it is important that it is important that people realize that effectively we are two funds that are funded through public assets.
Yes.
And it is for that reason that the two funds are actually NPCs, because effectively we are public interest organizations.
If for any reason on the insurance side the claim is greater than the amount that you're covering the lawyer for, what happens to that shortfall? In other words, I have a massive claim against the Road Accident Fund for 20 million,
yes,
and the lawyer forgot to submit my claim it prescribed. How much do you pay? You pay a small percentage of that.
We pay a certain percentage. Again, it's a structure of the firm.
Yeah. The lawyer would be liable for the rest?
For the rest.
Yes.
We pay up to a maximum of 3.125.
Mm.
And then after that, then it is the lawyer's liability that has to.
And that's why most big firms and most lawyers have their own professional indemnity for an amount in excess. But generally, you're covering the first amount, which is very important. Yeah.
We cover in the first amount, but it is also important to, when you look at the structure of PI in the whole country,
yes,
90 to 95% of the times, or in other words, of the hits where there has been a claim,
yes,
is still paid by this base layer. And consequently, because of that, you find that in South Africa, the top-up insurance, which is the one you're talking about,
yes,
is comparatively speaking fairly inexpensive in a South African sense.
Yes.
And people do cover themselves up to R1 billion and sometimes higher. Mm. There's big firms that really take those kind of amounts.
Mm.
But it is important to realize that 90 to 95% of the claims in South Africa are still covered by ourselves.
Excellent. Gents, we're running out of time. What we're going to do is we're going to follow up this podcast and we're going to discuss these issues in a little more detail. And questions we're going to talk to you about a little later or next time is what one should look out for when acquiring the services of a lawyer. What should we, as the public, what should we look for, and how the two funds in effect support both attorneys and consumers. So we're going to say farewell to you now. And we'll be back next week with another podcast. Many thanks for joining us, the two gentlemen from the Attorneys Indemnity Insurance Fund and the Attorneys Fidelity Fund. Yabonga kakhulu.
Siyabonga nathi.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on cliffcentral.com.
This is cliffcentral.com.